how you turn to God from idols to serve the living and true God. And that goes clear up to chapter 4, verse 12. And so those are the first two sections of the book. But now, here's what he says in verse 10. And to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, even Jesus, who delivers or saves us from the wrath to come. That is the outline for chapter 4, verse 13, until the end of the body of the book. But that is not talking about their salvation in the sense of when they believe. Waiting for our deliverer is talking about waiting for the one who is going to rapture us. Now, let's look at how he sets this up in that final section of the book where he's talking about waiting for our deliverer. We have an interesting thing that happens in 1 Thessalonians. It also happens in the book of 1 Corinthians. And that is that Paul, in this book, is answering a number of questions that have been written to him by the Thessalonians. 1 Corinthians has a very large section of the book where Paul is answering questions that the Corinthians had written to him. I want you to see how it is that Paul tells us that he's answering questions. Look at chapter 4, verse 9. But concerning brotherly love. They had written to him something about that. He said, "You have no need that I should write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another." Now let's see the second question that Paul deals with that they had talked about. Chapter 4, verse 13. But I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren. That's another way of saying, you wrote about a question here. I don't want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep. Now when we get to chapter 5, verse 1, but concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you. So notice in 4:9 he said, on this topic, I really don't need to write to you. You have a pretty good understanding. The second topic, verses 13 and following, he's saying, I need to write to you because you'd have some ignorance on this topic. And then on the third topic, 5:1, but concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you. So what we have to say is when he's talking about the future deliverance by Jesus, 4:13 introduces one topic and 5:1 introduces another topic. The topic introduced in 4:13 is about the rapture in this regard. Will any of the people who had already died miss out on the rapture? And he says they won't. Then in chapter 5, verse 1, we come to the question that Karen was asking about. And there, the question is, when does the day of the Lord come in? And Paul is going to relate that to the rapture. Let me focus upon what he ends up saying about the rapture. Is a very, very interesting thing. Let's see, I need to set up one more thing that I had not yet set up. And that is that when you look at 4:13 through 17, Paul uses one word that means to sleep, and that's the word koimao. Interestingly, we get the word coma from that word, and we get the word cemetery. A cemetery is a place of the sleepers. literally. And so koimao is one word for sleep. And every time the New Testament uses that of believers, it's used positively. And it always talks about death in the sense that the believer has what could be described as sleep. In the sense the believer is going to wake up to resurrection, the believer is going to be reawakened to physical life in the resurrection. So it's presented as sleep because it's a temporary status of being absent from the body. But then when he gets to chapter 5, he uses a different word for sleep. And that word is katheuto. By the way, if any of you have questions after I've talked about this, I have some articles I can send to you that will go into more depth on what I'm talking about. So if you can email me and I can send out some articles. But the word for sleep that's used in chapter 5 is the word katheuto. Katheuto is not used positively in the New Testament. Remember when the disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus wanted them to pray with him? And they were katheutoing. And he wasn't happy. And in Ephesians chapter 5, Paul wasn't happy with the Ephesians. He said that they needed to wake up. Well, the kind of sleep that they were having was katheuto. They were being lethargic in their Christianity. And here, katheuto is going to be used negatively as well. So he says, verse 4 of chapter 5, "But you, brethren, are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you as a thief." We are of the day, and it won't overtake us at all. People sometimes misread this and think that Paul's saying, well, it's not going to overtake you like a thief would overtake you, but it will overtake you. Within the argument, we're going to see a little later that Paul is not saying that. He's saying, you're of the day, you will not be overtaken by the day of the Lord. It will not overtake you at all. We're not going to be here on planet Earth at the time that that starts. So therefore, in verse 6, he says, let us not katheuto, let us not be lethargic as others, but let us watch and be sober. He's not talking about watching for that which can't be seen. We are not going to be able to predict the day or the hour of the rapture. He's not saying look for it and expect it and be watching for signs for it, because there are no signs. There's nothing that there will be, not even a split second warning for that. But what he's talking about is live an alert Christian life. Don't act like it's not important. I'm going to go to heaven. It's really not important how I live my life. He's saying, don't have an attitude like that. Be watchful. Be sober. For those who katheuto at night, those who get drunk are drunk at night. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet the hope of deliverance. For God did not appoint us to wrath. He's saying we are not appointed for that time of wrath. We are not appointed for the tribulation. The church is not appointed for that. The tribulation, as Daniel 9 makes very clear, is meant to prepare Israel to receive its Messiah. The church has no relationship to it. Then he says what the church has been appointed to, but to obtain deliverance through our Lord Jesus Christ. We already have the kind of salvation, if we're using the word salvation for what happens when we believe. We already have that. but for us to obtain the deliverance of the rapture. But now I want you to notice the next verse. Verse 10. Yes. Verse 10 is strategic. Who died for us, so that whether we wake or sleep. What word do you think is used here for sleep? We would think koimao, but Paul uses kathudo. Paul says the deliverance in the rapture is for all Christians, even Christians who kathudo, that whether we are watchful, whether we're living the way that we ought to, that he described in verse 6, or whether we are living a lethargic Christian life, that we should live together with him. Now, the way that I look at the preceding passage that we didn't really look at, I skipped over it, it's saying even dead believers are going to be raptured a split second before those that are alive at the time of the rapture. So what we can say is that when we look at chapter 4, verses 13 through 17, whether one is alive physically or dead physically at the time of the rapture, both are raptured. And chapter 5 says whether we are living for the Lord or we're living slothfully away from the Lord will also be raptured. But there is one group of people who doesn't have anything good happen at the rapture, and that's the ones that are described in the end of verse 13 in chapter 4. But I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep. And that word is koimao, those that have died, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. Unbelievers have no hope. Believers, whether they are alive at the time of the rapture or dead at the time of the rapture physically, they have hope. They will be delivered. And believers, whether we live for the Lord or we don't live for the Lord, we also have hope. We're going to be raptured. Now, something else that's fascinating about both of these passages is the way that they both end. Look at the ending of verse 18 in chapter 4. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. He's saying we should comfort one another that even if a fellow believer has died, that fellow believer is not going to miss out on the rapture. Now look at what he does at the end of the chapter that talks about kathudo. In 5:11, therefore comfort one another and edify one another just as you are doing. So he's saying, we're able to say, even if someone is a believer that has wandered away from the Lord, that believer will be raptured. But Paul has not discussed how much reward that person has thrown away. Rewards can be thrown away, but the rapture cannot. Let me look at another passage that people often use to try to say that believers who are not walking with the Lord won't be raptured. Let's look at Revelation 3:10. Now, this is a passage that you might have markings in your Bible, because I have written articles on this passage. I believe it should be repunctuated. So I'll tell you what the punctuation change that I make is. In Revelation 3, verse 9, your Bible ends with a period. I believe it should be a comma there. And in the middle of verse 10, you have a comma, and I believe it should be a period there. So, let me explain. I'm going to make a sentence that's going to use the word because, but I'm not going to tell you whether it's capitalized or not capitalized. I'm actually going to give you three sentences, or two sentences and one phrase. I ate breakfast because I was hungry. I ate an early lunch. Now the question is, am I saying I ate breakfast because I was hungry? I ate an early lunch. Or am I saying I ate breakfast because I was hungry, I ate lunch? The question is, does because go with what went before, or does it go with what went after? And both in Greek and in English, it is very rare to start a sentence with the word because. We have a technical term for it. We call it a suspensive clause. And neither Greek nor English liked those, so they are quite rare. The way that this is punctuated in our English Bibles is not the normal way that we would expect it to be. We have about 1,100 uses of this word that's translated because, and there are only about 10 places in the whole New Testament that have it as a capitalized because. So it's rare. But saying it's rare doesn't prove that it's wrong. It can happen. So now I'm going to give some reasons that I think that we should change the punctuation. When you look at 3:10, you're going to notice that it has the word keep twice. He says, and I'll read it as it's punctuated, because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour. But I want you to notice there's another passage in this same paragraph that has the word keep, and that's in verse 8. It says, see, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it, for you have a little strength. You have kept my word. Notice how similar that last phrase is to the opening of verse 10. And actually, it looks even more similar when you're looking in Greek, because in 3:10, it's literally, you have kept the word of my perseverance. So, when he talks in verse 8 and he talks in verse 10 about keeping his word, that's talking about obeying it. But when he talks about keeping them from the hour, that's talking about deliverance. So I would argue that verse 10a is closer in its meaning to what precedes than it is to what follows. But then there's something else fascinating, and that is in the middle of verse 10, it says, I also. And I can't make sense of that also under the normal punctuation. It doesn't really make sense. When I diagram it, I look at it and I say, what is that doing? But it could also be translated and. What I think that it does is it connects the I's of the passage. I'm going to read the passage, but I'm going to emphasize the word I and the verb that is connected with it. Starting in verse 8, I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. For you have a little strength, have kept my word, have not denied my name. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan, who say that they are Jews, but are not, but lie. Indeed, I will make them come and worship, that is, worship me, before your feet, and to know that I have loved you because you have kept my command to persevere. And I will also keep you from the hour of trial, which is about to come upon the whole inhabited earth, and so on and so forth. So the and connects all the I's. Okay, I've gotten a lot of interference, so I didn't...
I think it's Renee in there.
Renee, I didn't quite understand. We're getting echoes.
Yeah, they muted their mic.
So, let me tell you how people look at this passage. They say, it looks like, with the present punctuation, that it is because of their faithfulness that they're going to be kept from the hour. But let me ask a question. Was the way that they escaped the hour, did that happen by means of the rapture? No, they died. Jesus does not here say the means by which he will keep them from the hour. The first century church, all of those believers died. Their death prevented them from entering the tribulation. The passage does not say how he will deliver people. It is my belief that every generation prior to the rapture generation receives its deliverance, receives the way that they are kept from entering the tribulation by means of physical death. Nowhere do you see him say, the way I will deliver you is by the rapture. But for the last generation of the church, the rapture generation, the truth is also they will not be allowed to enter into the tribulation. What is being promised here is the special promise to them is, I am going to give vindication of you before your enemies. When he talks about the prevention of them going into the tribulation, that's a truth that's guaranteed for everyone, and he's not saying it's based on your faithfulness. When we properly punctuate this, he says, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan come and bow down before your feet and to know that I have loved you because you have kept the word of my perseverance. And by the way, I'm going to prevent you from entering the tribulation. Now, he could have done that through the rapture, but the way that they were prevented from entering it was by physical death. So,
don't try to tell that to people who are dying from coronavirus. That they say based on dying.
Well, yeah, death. Death is not a pleasant thing. It's a consequence of the fall, and that. But death did prevent them from entering the tribulation. It delivered them into the presence of the Lord, and they weren't allowed to enter the tribulation. Nowhere in the New Testament do we have any sort of timetable given as to when the rapture will happen. So he's reminding them, you're going through a tough time, but I'm not going to allow you to enter the tribulation. He's reminding them of that truth and saying, I'm going to give vindication. I'm going to do that because of your faithfulness. But remember, it's already guaranteed you're not going to enter the tribulation. I mean, he doesn't specify here the means. He doesn't say, I'm going to deliver you by death, nor does he say, I'm going to deliver you by the rapture. What he says is, I'm not going to let you enter the tribulation.
I love the way you read it, more as one sentence from 8 to 11. He does speak in life.
Which passage?
He likes it.
Revelation 3. We read it together.
Yes.
And I think, yeah, I like how you read it there. That's what the emphasis on.
Yeah, and as I said, if you want to read articles that I've written, I've got articles that I can supply you with.
Well, there's a lot of articles here. Yeah. That's good. Thank you.
Do we have further questions?
It's
just one last question. Okay. Before we start, in Daniel. So, looking at 1 Thessalonians chapters 4 and 5, do you think that people that don't believe in the rapture and believe that you in Lordship salvation, that you have to persevere to the end, spilled coffee on their Bible in that area?
I think so. Yep. Let me say something that I was careful to show from concerning this. You have no need for me to write concerning this. I don't want you to be ignorant concerning this. You don't have a need for me to write. It tells us that we have two distinct topics in 4:13 through 17, as opposed to 5:1 through 11. That's important to note, because anytime you read anyone that rejects the pre-trib rapture, they will treat 4:13 through 5:11 as one topic. And Paul sets up very clearly, it's two distinct topics. Understanding that it's two distinct topics helps us to see that, you know, he might really be making a point, a distinction between koimao and kathuro, even though it's translated the same way. It's translated sleep. And what I ask all non-pre-trib people that want to talk to me about this passage, is it really comforting to know that I might have to go through 6 years and 11 months of the tribulation? I mean, how comforting is that?
Well, and the other thing is it comforting to know that the second part, if you were sleeping, not doing what you were supposed to be doing, that you go to the lake of fire, that's kind of comforting.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, any interpretation of 4:13 through 17 and of 5:1 through 11 have to be comforting. They have to be good. They have to be good news for believers. But notice this is giving a clarification on wrath, and it's also giving a clarification on Paul's use of the word sozo for salvation or deliverance. Okay, let's look at Daniel. Right now I realize it would have been good if I had put up my chiasm, but let's review that. The Aramaic section of Daniel is in chapters 2 through 7. Daniel chapter 2 looked, I guess it works here this way. But Daniel 2 looks at the great statue that have the head of gold on down to the feet of iron mixed with clay. That was picturing four successive kingdoms: Babylon, Persia, then Greece, and then finally Rome. When we get to Daniel chapter 7, it's going to be a bookend for that in a chiastic structure. And it's going to look at the same four kingdoms, and it's going to look at the coming of the one-legged Son of Man. But then if we look at chapters 3 and 6, again setting up a chiasm, chapter 3 is looking at the fiery furnace, and that corresponds to chapter 6, the chapter that we're in, of the lion's den. And then chapter 4 and chapter 5 also correspond to each other. We have the humiliation of Nebuchadnezzar and the humiliation of Belshazzar. Daniel has set these up in a chiastic structure in order to say God is in control of history. And so we're going to look here at Daniel in the lion's den, and it's showing how God was able to make his point even again in a Gentile country under Persian rule, that he is the one supreme God. And as with Nebuchadnezzar, the king ultimately gives a positive sort of response to saying no one should persecute Daniel, he's standing for the truth, and so forth. Now we have date stamps in the book of Daniel. Okay, I guess I've got to use my clicker. Okay, that is...
There we go.
So, the date stamps, remember we saw that the chapters are not all in chronological order, they're in a logical order, with chapters 2 through 7 being set up in that chiasm. So what Daniel tends to do in his chapters is to give a date stamp in order to be able to figure out what the chronology is. And so the sequence of them, as you can see, chapter 5 is something that happens after chapter 7 and chapter 8. But Darius was victorious. We saw that when they had their big party and the handwriting on the wall came last time when we were looking at this. And we will see Darius in this same chapter. Darius, I believe, is an alternate name for Cyrus. There are a couple of different takes on it. It depends on how one translates one little word in this as to exactly how this fits together. And the way that I would translate Daniel 6:28, Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, even the reign of Cyrus, the Persian. The concept there is that Darius and Cyrus are one and the same person. Scholars have wrestled with trying to figure out who is Darius, and a lot of skeptics have made big points over that, but it is quite reasonable here in the text because so many kings had multiple names that he would have gone by more than one name. And so I take it that Darius and Cyrus are the same person. Darius conquered Babylon in the year 539. This would be subsequent to that time, but it would be before... it's somewhat after that, after Darius has taken command, that he makes appointments. And so the next portion of this is where, in the outline, that Daniel is exalted by Darius, that is by Cyrus, in verses 1 through 3. They needed administrators. This is a great increase in the size of the Persian Empire. And that's, so if we look at the Persian Empire, oops, clicked the wrong one. This is the Persian Empire after the absorption of Babylon. You can see this is huge. It is covering a major area, with Babylon being here where the star is, Jerusalem being here. So when later on Daniel is facing towards Jerusalem, it just means he was facing out his west window towards Jerusalem as he prayed. Now let's look at how big an area was absorbed as they absorbed Babylon. It's clear that they're going to need to have people to administer this whole area. And Darius has to find people that are loyal, that are going to be able to administer it. Now, of the satrapies that we know about, these are ones that we know about, but these could be divided up further. We're told here in this chapter that there are going to be 120 of them.
What is a satrapy?
It'd be like a province. Okay. It'd be an area or a state within this kingdom. So they needed to have various people administering. One of the main things that they were concerned about was administering taxes. Just think, we got to treat April 15th like just an ordinary day. That hasn't normally happened. I mean, you know, yesterday for a lot of people would have been the panic time, have to get taxes in. And this year we have a bit of a reprieve. But Darius was concerned to make sure that as taxes were being collected, that the proper amount of money ended up going into Persian coffers. So he's looking for honest people who are capable administrators. That's very important as we look at 6:1 through 3. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom, and over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them, in particular give account largely in regard to the collection of revenues, so that the king would suffer no loss. They didn't want anyone stealing any of the money. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and the satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. So, as we look at this passage, I thought that I put a thing in the PowerPoint, but I guess it's only in your notes. I set up a little chart. Daniel is governor number one. There are two other governors. And then I treated it as though there were 40 satraps under each of them. We don't know exactly how it was set up, but it could have looked something like this. And so you have 122 people that are saying, Daniel's over us. And as in any hierarchy, there's a desire by the underlings to become the overlings. And so that sets up for what we have in the next section. In verses 4 and 5, a conspiracy develops against Daniel. You have to remember, a lot of these people might have been natives, and lo and behold, Daniel isn't even Babylonian. He's Jewish. There are going to be a lot of things against him, a lot of reasons that people wouldn't like him. He's over them, and he's probably unique among them as being probably the only Jewish person. So in verses 4 and 5, we have a conspiracy against Daniel. I think jealousy and self-promotion would probably have a lot to do with this. In verse 4, so the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful. Nor was there any error or fault found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." So essentially, they're saying, well, he seems like an honorable person. Haven't found any things that we can even bring any fake news against him. So maybe the key is that we can make his religion illegal. I look at our country and I say, there's a lot of effort to make Christianity illegal. Look at how any religion but Christianity ends up being favored. I mean, you could stand up for it. I mean, it's just astounding to me as I look at it as to how so much of everything is being aimed against Christianity. I think that was essentially what was going on with Daniel. People are saying, well, he's exemplary, so now we're going to attack his religion. We can figure out a way to get a wedge between him and the king. So that's exactly what they sought to do. So going again back to our outline, they tricked the king, King Darius, into making a decree against prayer. Sounds like 1963 here in the United States, and ever since. In verses 6 through 9, "So these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said thus to him, 'King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom," all of them except Daniel, "the administrators, the counselors and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter." Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. Sounds like Pelosi pulled one over him. And with regard to the law of the Medes and Persians, if you write in cuneiform, the only way you can undo it there from a physical standpoint is smear some clay over the top of it and so forth, but then you can't make the impressions. So essentially, just the writing formula that they use of cuneiform in soft clay that would then dry, they didn't really have an easy delete feature on their computers. They didn't have an easy erase feature, and the Persians had this as a slogan that their laws were unchangeable. So anyway, they come up with this idea, and King doesn't see anything wrong with it. He goes ahead and he puts it into effect. But what they have done is they have designed a decree that is only aimed at one person, and that's against Daniel. So, once again, we have Daniel's response, and Daniel refuses to cave in. And what I've depicted here is windows, because Daniel could have closed his blinds and still prayed towards Jerusalem and kept it hidden. But Daniel continued to pray the way that he had always done. He left his windows open. People were able to see him. He was not in fear of man. he openly did what he knew was right. And so, in verse 10, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with his windows open towards Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day, prayed, and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. The very fact that Daniel was loyal to his God made it so that he wasn't doing anything for show. He was doing it because he sincerely wanted to walk with his Lord, and he maintained his normal procedures even when the laws changed. You know, I've had a lot of chance during our shelter at home in the past several weeks to reflect on passages like this. I think it's kind of interesting that here we are in Daniel. How easy it is for governments to do what they think is the best thing, and it's a tough balancing act here, as we have constitutional liberties, but we also have a pandemic. And we just really have to be on guard at times like this, that we don't give up what God wants us to stand for. You know, I don't have any problem with staying at home. I don't like having to stay at home all the time. I think it's wise to do so, but I'm going to use every means I can to continue to get the Word of God out. And if the government were to say, it would be a really good idea for the churches to remain shut down, I'd have a real problem with that. Or if they decided that they were going to shut down our opportunity to speak in any way that we can, if we start facing direct opposition by the government, we need to take a stand. You know, one of the things that our pastor says that I think is quite wise is that the government may permit things that we regard as wrong, but we really must take an issue when the government is trying to make us do something that's wrong. We take as much of a stand as we possibly can to try to make it so that the Word of God goes forth, and that God's viewpoint be held up. You know, it's a terrible thing the way that we have the abortion mills, and we have all sorts of things going on like that. We need to take our steps that we can in order to preserve life. But if the government starts to interfere with our ability to worship, we need, like Daniel, to stand up courageously and continue to do what is right, even if the government says that it's wrong. And we see that within the text of the Bible. And we see that here, we see it elsewhere. God has given us opportunity at the times that the government becomes too intrusive, that we need to be willing to stand up for the things of the Lord. And right now we're at one of those times where the government isn't prohibiting us, but it could very easily come to that, and we have to be definitely on guard. Daniel prayed with his windows open. So what happened? He then was willing to accept the consequences, as he was accused before Darius. verses 12 through 15, we have where the accusation is brought against him, and once again, it's down to Darius can't undo the decree that he has posted. In verses 12 and following, he's accused. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God, and they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which does not alter. So they answered and said before the king that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day. And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. So here we are once again. Daniel is accused. The king doesn't want this to be the case. So then in verse 15, in verse 14, the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men approached the king and said to the king, "Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and the Persians that no decree or statute which the king established may be changed." He's looking for an escape clause. He's not able to find one. His advisors come back and say, there is no escape clause. And as a result, in verses 16 and 17, Daniel is cast into the lion's den. So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, "Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you." Then a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. So they carry out the sentence, but even Darius knows that God is capable of delivering Daniel. How similar, the thought struck me in reading verse 17, a thought that had not struck me before, but I've been working so much in John, and especially looking at the final sections of John. Over Jesus' tomb, there was a stone that was put over it, and the tomb was sealed to make sure that no one would tamper with it. And lo and behold, that's done here. But once again, God delivers. And so I don't have any further slides, so we'll just leave this slide up for the remainder. So in verses 18 through 20, the king makes a lament for Daniel. Now the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no musicians were brought before him. Also his sleep went from him. Then the king rose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" And Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angels and shut the lions' mouths, so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you." And of course, then in verse 23, "Now the king was exceedingly glad for him, commanded that they should take Daniel out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatsoever was found on him, because he believed in his God. So he was delivered. But then we have his enemies are destroyed in verse 24. And the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel. And they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, their wives. And the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den.
Wow.
Now, the passage doesn't tell us that all 122 of those that were under Daniel were cast in here, but the ones who made the accusations, the ones that were the ringleaders, have no idea how many that was. If it were the 122, it would have happened over a period of time. But this sounds like a description. They were all thrown in at once, and they were devoured instantly. Darius then makes a decree, similar to the decree that was made by Nebuchadnezzar back in chapter 3. Then King Darius wrote, "To all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth." Remember, he had an empire. There were lots of people from lots of conquered countries that were within his empire. "Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end." Somehow, Darius knows truths of Daniel 7 or Daniel 2. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, even, as you remember the translation from the Aramaic that I recommend, even in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So I think this is a timely passage as we're, I've listened on Fox News, and the governor of New Jersey was questioned by Tucker Carlson. He said, "Did you think about the Bill of Rights as you wrote this decree?" And he said, "No, that wasn't on my mind at all." And Tucker Carlson said, "That's clear." This is a time where we're seeing some that are going way too far in trying to protect people from COVID. We need to be on guard. Any comments, any questions?
Steve.
You know, John, after you said that, it's amazing that there's a stone rolled in front and a signet in the declaration, much like Jesus.
Yep.
That is amazing.
Yep.
John, one question here. The last verse, so this Daniel refers, so it prospered in the reign of Darius, even the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So my question is here, is somebody else writing about Daniel? Or somebody else wrote with Daniel this section?
Daniel refers to himself in the third person pretty regularly in this book. So, I think it's Daniel's own words, but look at how he says in 7:1, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on the bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. I think he refers to himself in the third person. That's my sense here in the book of Daniel. It seems to be a recurring feature.
So another similarity between him and John? And
yep. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, even Belshazzar had made promises to Daniel, and he was told he was going to die that very night, but he made Daniel third in the command and so on and so forth. He followed through because he understood that Daniel was speaking truth, which is a testimony to understanding that his God was the God that was in charge overall. Which is an interesting thing for him to have said after drinking out of the temple vessels. Because that action was saying, well, our gods delivered Judah into our hands. Our gods will protect us from the Medes and Persians. Daniel interprets the vision, and Belshazzar doesn't retaliate against Daniel, even though it's very bad news. Sure.
You know, because the people said, gee, we want a king.
Yes.
And to the extent that this story has a king and has a believer in it, can we also live in an era where we have a government and we also have Jesus as our king, and how we relate to that, you know, to the extent
yes.
of what First Samuel was saying, just a parallel. I'll have to think about it.
Sure. And
in regards to that.
And it's possible to look at another place also, and that's Moses in the law gave descriptions of what it was going to be like to have a king. Because any king other than the Messiah is going to tend to have the excesses that were described there. It's just a universal feature. We got an email with an interesting picture earlier this week from a friend in Idaho. And so he said, I thought you'd enjoy this. One of the ladies in his church is sewing together masks. And so she has them hanging apparently from her mailbox in plastic bags. And she also has Living Waters and a sign that take one of these books and take one of these masks. So little ways to be able to minister to people. And times of crisis do make it so that people are more receptive. I mean, it tends to cause people to start reevaluating things, and sometimes it can produce some really neat opportunities.